meaning. It used to refer to the kind of behavior that Lance Armstrong showed Jan Ullrich, but over time, the term was stretched to include unimpressive, non-chivalrous behavior, like losing without whining too much, or making it through an entire game without assaulting a referee. Thompson and the PCA needed a different way of encouraging people, not just to avoid bad behavior, but to embrace good behavior. They called it honoring the game. People care about sports. They care about the game. It's a way of making the point that the game and its integrity are larger than the individual participants. Honoring the game is a kind of sports patriotism. It implies that you owe your sport basic respect. Armstrong wasn't being a good sport. He was honoring the game. And honoring the game also works for people other than players. It reminds anyone that sports is a civic institution. It's unseemly to mess with an institution. It's dishonorable. Is there any proof that honoring the game works? Consider the data gathered by a basketball league in Dallas, Texas. In the 2002 basketball season, on average, there was a technical foul called every 15 games. Since that time, we've conducted 6 double goal coach workshops. In the 2004 basketball season, there was a technical foul called every 52 games. A baseball league in Northern California found that after positive coaching training, there was a dramatic reduction, 90%, in the number of people who were ejected from games for bad behavior. Team morale improved so much that the number of players enrolling in the league increased by 20%. The only complaint was that they were running out of fields. Thompson doesn't want to change just the culture of youth sports. He wants to change the culture of all sports. I have a fantasy. I'm watching the World Series and a manager comes rushing onto the field to berate an umpire who made a call he disagrees with. On national TV, Bob Costas says, "That's really too bad to see the manager dishonoring the game of baseball that way." As a side note, notice how wonderfully concrete this vision is. Youth sports hasn't been purged of discourtesy, but Thompson is making a tangible difference in the places he's reached. And with honoring the game, he has managed to sidestep semantic stretch and peg an idea that makes people care. The lesson for the rest of us is that if we want to make people care, we've got to tap into the things they care about. When everybody taps into the same thing, an arms race emerges. To avoid it, we've either got to shift onto new turf, as Thompson did, or find associations that are distinctive for our ideas. Appealing to self-interest. We're searching for ways to make people care about our ideas, to make them care about the African child Rokia, about smoking, about charity, about sportsmanship. We make people care by appealing to things that matter to them. And what matters to people? So far, we've dealt with associations, but there's a more direct answer. In fact, it might be the most obvious answer of all. What matters to people? People matter to themselves. It will come as no surprise that one reliable way of making people care is by invoking self-interest. In 1925, John Caples was assigned to write a headline for an advertisement promoting the correspondence music course offered by the U.S. School of Music. Caples had no advertising experience, but he was a natural. He sat at his typewriter and pecked out the most famous headline in print advertising history. "They laughed when I sat down at the piano, but when I started to play..." This is a classic underdog story in 15 words. People laughed at him, and he shut them up through his playing. The headline is enthralling enough to make us overlook common sense reactions like, why would anyone laugh at someone sitting down at a piano? When was the last time you laughed at someone who sat down at a piano? The headline was so successful at selling correspondence courses that it's still being ripped off by copywriters decades later. 60 years later, the following knockoff headline increased sales by 26% over the previous year. "My husband laughed when I ordered our carpet through the mail, but when I say 50%, Our publisher rejected the following subtitle for this book: "They laughed when we wrote this book, but when they woke up in an ice-filled bathtub. Caples helped establish mail-order advertising, the forerunner of the modern infomercial. In mail-order advertising, unlike most other forms of advertising, advertisers know exactly how well an ad works. Say there's an ad for a stock-picking guide in a newspaper or a magazine. If you want to order the stock-picking guide, you send off a check to the address listed in the ad. But each version of an ad lists a slightly different address. So when your order shows up at a particular address, the marketer knows precisely which ad generated the sale. Contrast mail-order ads with a classic consumer product like Crest. Why does someone buy a tube of Crest? Is it because of the new TV ads? Or was it the discount price at retail? Or the fancy new package design? Or the fact that Mom always used Crest? Or that it was the only brand in stock that day? Marketers have surprisingly little ability to tell. Because mail order advertising is so transparent, it's essentially a laboratory for assessing motivational appeals. What makes people care? Ask a direct mail copywriter. And John Caples is often cited as the greatest copywriter of all time. He says, "First and foremost, try to get self-interest into every headline you write. Make your headline suggest to readers that here is something they want. This rule is so fundamental that it would seem obvious, yet the rule is violated every day by scores of writers." Caples' ads get self-interest into their headlines by promising huge benefits for trivial costs. You can laugh at money worries if you follow this simple plan. Give me 5 days and I'll give you a magnetic personality. Let me prove it. Free. The secret of how to be taller. How you can improve your memory in one evening. Retire at 55. Caples says companies often emphasize features when they should be emphasizing benefits. The most frequent reason for unsuccessful advertising is advertisers who are so full of their own accomplishments, the world's best seed, that they forget to tell us why we should buy the world's best lawn. An old advertising maxim says you've got to spell out the benefit of the benefit. In other words, people don't buy quarter-inch drill bits. They buy quarter-inch holes so they can hang their children's pictures. We get uncomfortable looking at Caples' handiwork. Many of his ads are shady, deceptive. The manufacturers of the magnetic personality kit may enjoy a conscience-free existence, but most of us aspire to a working relationship with the truth. So what's the non-advertising, non-schlocky takeaway from Caples' techniques? The first lesson is not to overlook self-interest. Jerry Weissman, a former TV producer and screenwriter who now coaches CEOs in how to deliver speeches, says that you shouldn't dance around the appeal to self-interest. He says that the WIIFY, what's in it for you, pronounced Wiffy, should be a central aspect of every speech. Weissman notes that some people resist spelling out the message. "But my audiences aren't stupid," he quotes the resistors. "They might even feel insulted if I spell it out for them." For an audience that may be distracted, though, spelling it out has value. Even if it takes them just a few seconds to connect the dots between the feature you describe and the implied benefit, by the time they catch up, you will have moved on to your next point, and they probably won't have time to absorb the benefit or the next point. Teachers are all too familiar with the student refrain, "How are we ever going to use this?" In other words, "What's in it for me?" If the whiffy was that algebra made students better at video games, would any teacher hesitate to say so? Does any teacher doubt that students would pay more attention? If you've got self-interest on your side, don't bury it. Don't talk around it. Even subtle tweaks can make a difference. It's important, Caples says, to keep the self in self-interest. Don't say, "People will enjoy a sense of security when they use Goodyear tires." Say, "You enjoy a sense of security when you use Goodyear tires." Of course, there are less obnoxious, less overt ways to appeal to self-interest than those promoted by mail-order ads. To explore this, we'll start with a rather odd study conducted in Tempe, Arizona. Cable TV in Tempe. In 1982, psychologists conducted a study on persuasion with a group of homeowners in Tempe, Arizona. The homeowners were visited by student volunteers who asked them to fill out surveys for a class project. At the time, cable TV was just starting to appear. It was still unfamiliar to most people. The research study was designed to compare the success of two different approaches to educating the homeowners about the potential benefits of cable TV. One group of homeowners was presented with some information about why cable might be worthwhile. CATV will provide a broader entertainment and informational service to its subscribers. Used properly, a person can plan in advance to enjoy events offered. Instead of spending money on the babysitter and gas, and putting up with the hassles of going out, more time can be spent at home with family, alone, or with friends. The second group of homeowners was asked to imagine themselves in a detailed scenario. Take a moment and imagine how CATV will provide you with a broader entertainment and informational service. When you use it properly, you will be able to plan in advance which of the events offered you wish to enjoy. Take a moment and think of how, instead of spending money on the babysitter and gas, and then having to put up with the hassles of going out, you will be able to spend your time at home, with your family, alone, or with your friends. Some readers have said that at first they didn't see any difference between the two appeals. The difference is subtle. But go back and count up the number of times the word "you" appears in each appeal. In a sense, the study was a more elaborate version of Capel's advice to avoid talking about abstract benefits. People will enjoy a sense of security when they use Goodyear tires, and focus on personal benefits. You enjoy a sense of security when you use Goodyear tires. The Arizona study, though, took a step further. It asked people to visualize the feeling of security they would get by using Goodyear tires. The homeowners filled out a questionnaire for the students and said goodbye. They thought they were finished with the research project, but the researchers still had another stage to complete. A month after the survey was conducted, cable TV arrived in Tempe. The local cable company approached the homeowners for subscriptions. The university researchers managed to get subscriber data from the cable company. They then analyzed which homeowners had subscribed and which hadn't. The homeowners who got information about cable subscribed at a rate of 20%, which was about the same as the rest of the neighborhood. But the homeowners who imagined themselves subscribing to cable subscribed at a rate of 47%. The research paper, when it was published, was subtitled, "Does Imagining Make It So?" The answer was yes. Compared with a typical mail-order ad, the Imagine Cable Television appeal is a much more subtle appeal to self-interest. Note that the benefits offered were not fantastic in a Capel-esque way. The gist was that you could avoid the hassle of leaving home by ordering cable. Indeed, just hearing about the benefits in the abstract wasn't enough to lure additional subscribers. It was only when people put themselves in the starring role. I can see myself watching a good movie at home with my hubby, and I can get up and check on the kids in the next room whenever I like, and think of all that babysitting money I'd save. That their interest grew. The finding suggests that it may be the tangibility rather than the magnitude of the benefits that makes people care. You don't have to promise riches and sex appeal and magnetic personalities. It may be enough to promise reasonable benefits that people can easily imagine themselves enjoying. Imagine that Save the Children incorporated this idea into its pitches for sponsorship. Right now the pitch is, you can sponsor Rokia, a little girl in Mali, for $30 a month. A pitch that is already successful. But what if the pitch was expanded? Imagine yourself as the sponsor of Rokia, a little girl in Mali. You've got a picture of her on your desk at work next to your kids' pictures. During the past year, you've traded letters with her 3 times, and you know from the letters that she loves to read and frequently gets annoyed by her little brother. She is excited that next year she'll get to play on the soccer team. That's powerful, and it's not crass. Maslow. Self-interest isn't the whole story, of course, especially if we define self-interest narrowly, as we often do, in terms of wealth and security. If it were the whole story, No one would ever serve in the armed forces. There are things people care about that would never appear in a Caples ad. In 1954, a psychologist named Abraham Maslow surveyed the research in psychology about what motivates people. He boiled down volumes of existing research to a list of needs and desires that people try to fulfill. Transcendence, help others realize their potential. Self-actualization, realize our own potential, self-fulfillment, peak experiences. Aesthetic, symmetry, order, beauty, balance. Learning, know, understand, mentally connect. Esteem, achieve, be competent, gain approval, independence, status. Belonging, love, family, friends, affection. Security, protection, safety, stability. Physical, hunger, thirst, bodily comfort. You may remember this list as Maslow's pyramid or Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Maslow's list of needs was incredibly insightful, but he was wrong to describe it as a hierarchy. Maslow saw the hierarchy as a ladder to be climbed rung by rung from the bottom up. You couldn't feel your longing for esteem until you satisfied your longing for security. You couldn't feel your aesthetic needs until your physical needs were taken care of. In Maslow's world, there were no starving artists. Subsequent research suggests that the hierarchical aspect of Maslow's theory is bogus. People pursue all of these needs pretty much simultaneously. There's no question that most starving men would rather eat than transcend, but there's an awful lot of overlap in the middle. When people talk about self-interest, they're typically invoking the physical, security, and esteem layers. Sometimes belonging gets acknowledged if the speaker is touchy-feely. Not many marketers or managers venture far beyond these categories. Even appeals that seem to fall under the aesthetic category are often really esteem-related, but in disguise, e.g., a luxury auto ad. There could be a very good reason that people focus on these particular categories. Maybe those are the ones that truly matter. The rest of them, self-actualization, transcendence, and so on, do seem a bit academic. Recent research has explored this question, helping to shed light on which of Maslow's categories made people care. Imagine that a company offers its employees a $1,000 bonus if they meet certain performance targets. There are three different ways of presenting the bonus to the employees. One, think of what that $1,000 means. A down payment on a new car or that new home improvement you've been wanting to make. Two, think of the increased security of having that $1,000 in your bank account for a rainy day. Three, think of what that $1,000 means. The company recognizes how important you are to its overall performance. It doesn't spend money for nothing. When people are asked which positioning would appeal to them personally, most of them say number three. It's good for the self-esteem, and as for number one and number two, isn't it kind of obvious that $1,000 can be spent or saved? Most of us have no trouble at all visualizing ourselves spending $1,000. It's a bit less common to find people who like to visualize themselves saving. Here's the twist, though. When people are asked which is the best positioning for other people, not them, they rank number one most fulfilling, followed by number two. That is, we are motivated by self-esteem, but others are motivated by down payments. This single insight explains almost everything about the way incentives are structured in most large organizations. Or consider another version of the same task. Let's say you're trying to persuade someone to take a new job in a department that's crucial to the company's success. Here are three possible pitches for the new job. One, think about how much security this job provides. It's so important that the company will always need someone in this job. Two, think about the visibility provided by this job. Because the job is so important, a lot of people will be watching your performance. Three, think about how rewarding it will be to work in such a central job. It offers a unique opportunity to learn how the company really works. The chasm between ourselves and others opens again. Most people say number three, an appeal to learning, would be most motivating for them. Those same people predict that others would be most motivated by number one, security, and number two, esteem. In other words, a lot of us think everyone else is living in Maslow's basement. We may have a penthouse apartment, but everyone else is living below. The result of spending too much time in Maslow's basement is that we may overlook lots of opportunities to motivate people. It's not that the bottom floors or the more tangible physical needs, to avoid the hierarchy metaphor, aren't motivational. Of course they are. We all like to get bonuses and to have job security and to feel like we fit in. But to focus on these needs exclusively robs us of the chance to tap more profound motivations. A great example of using these more profound motivations involves a retired member of the U.S. Army. Not a battlefield commander, but a guy who ran a mess hall. Dining in Iraq. Army food is just about what you'd expect. Bland, overcooked, and prepared in massive quantities. The dishes are not garnished with sprigs of parsley. The mess halls are essentially calorie factories, giving the troops the fuel they need to do their jobs. An old army proverb says an army travels on its stomach. The Pegasus Chow Hall, just outside the Baghdad airport, has developed a different reputation. At Pegasus, the prime rib is perfectly prepared. The fruit platter is a beautiful assortment of watermelon, kiwi fruit, and grapes. There are legends of soldiers driving to Pegasus from the Green Zone, the well-protected Americanized area of Baghdad, along one of the most treacherous roads in Iraq, just to eat a meal. Floyd Lee, the man in charge of Pegasus, was retired from his 25-year career as a Marine Corps and Army cook when the Iraq War began. He came out of retirement to take the job. "The good Lord gave me a second chance to feed soldiers," he said. "I've waited for this job all my life, and here I am in Baghdad." Lee is well aware that being a soldier is relentlessly difficult. The soldiers often work 18-hour days, 7 days a week. The threat of danger in Iraq is constant. Lee wants Pegasus to provide a respite from the turmoil. He's clear about his leadership mission. "As I see it, I'm not just in charge of food service, I am in charge of morale." Think about that. I am in charge of morale. In terms of Maslow's hierarchy, Lee is going for transcendence. This vision manifests itself in hundreds of small actions taken by Lee's staff on a daily basis. At Pegasus, the white walls of the typical mess hall are covered with sports banners. There are gold treatments on the windows and green tablecloths with tassels. The harsh fluorescent lights have been replaced by ceiling fans with soft bulbs. The servers wear tall white chef's hats. The remarkable thing about Pegasus's reputation for great food is that Pegasus works with exactly the same raw materials that everyone else does. Pegasus serves the same 21-day army menu as other dining halls. Its food comes from the same suppliers. It's the attitude that makes the difference. A chef sorts through the daily fruit shipment, culling the bad grapes, selecting the best parts of the watermelon and kiwi to prepare the perfect fruit tray. At night, the dessert table features 5 kinds of pie and 3 kinds of cake. The Sunday prime rib is marinated for 2 full days. A cook from New Orleans orders spices that are mailed to Iraq to enhance the entrees. A dessert chef describes her strawberry cake as sexual and sensual, 2 adjectives never before applied to army food. Lee realizes that serving food is a job, but improving morale is a mission. Improving morale involves creativity and experimentation and mastery. Serving food involves a ladle. One of the soldiers who commute to Pegasus for Sunday dinner said, "The time you are in here, you forget you're in Iraq." Lee is tapping into Maslow's forgotten categories, the aesthetic, learning, and transcendence needs. In redefining the mission of his mess hall, he has inspired his co-workers to create an oasis in the desert. The Popcorn Popper and Political Science. Even John Caples, the mail-order copywriter, admits that there are powerful motivations outside narrow self-interests. He tells a story about a marketer who was promoting a new educational film on fire safety that was intended to help firemen. This marketer had been taught that there are three basic consumer appeals: sex, greed, and fear. The marketer's instinct was that greed would work best in this situation. He came up with a couple of ideas for free giveaways that would persuade firemen to check out the film. He began calling local units to figure out which giveaway would have the most appeal. When he called, he would describe the new film and ask, "Would you like to see the film for possible purchase for your educational programs?" The universal answer was an enthusiastic yes. The second question tested two versions of his greed appeal. Would your firefighters prefer a large electric popcorn popper or an excellent set of chef's carving knives as a thank you for reviewing the film? The first two calls yielded definitive answers to this question. Do you think we'd use a fire safety program because of some blankety-blank popcorn popper? The marketer stopped asking about the free gifts. So sometimes self-interest helps people care, and sometimes it backfires. What are we to make of this? The mystery deepens if we consider politics. The conventional wisdom is that voters are paragons of self-interest. If there's a proposal on the table to raise the marginal tax rate on the highest incomes, we expect rich people to vote against it and everyone else to vote for it. Actually, this conventional wisdom is wrong. There's not much evidence that public opinion can be predicted by narrow self-interest. In 1998, Donald Kinder, a professor of political science at the University of Michigan, wrote an influential survey of 30 years of research on this topic. He summarizes the effects of self-interest on political views as trifling. Trifling, Kinder writes. When faced with affirmative action, white and black Americans come to their views without calculating personal harms or benefits. The unemployed do not line up behind policies designed to alleviate economic distress. The medically needy are no more likely to favor government health insurance than the fully insured. Parents of children in public schools are not more likely to support government aid to education than other citizens. Americans who are likely to be drafted are not more likely to oppose military intervention or escalating conflicts that are underway. Women employed outside the home do not differ from homemakers in their support of policies intended to benefit women at work. On such diverse matters as racial busing for the purpose of school desegregation, anti-drinking ordinances, mandatory college examinations, housing policy, bilingual education, compliance with laws, satisfaction with the resolution of legal disputes, gun control, and more, self-interest turns out to be quite unimportant. These findings are bracingly counterintuitive. If people aren't supporting their own self-interest, whose interests are they supporting? The answer is nuanced. First, self-interest does seem to matter quite a bit when the effects of a public policy are significant, tangible, and immediate. For example, in California in 1978, a ballot initiative called Proposition 13 called for a sharp reduction in property taxes in exchange for equally sharp reductions in public services such as schools, libraries, and police and fire departments. On this issue, homeowners, tired of the huge tax increases that accompany rising property values, voted for Proposition 13. Librarians and firefighters, among others, voted against it. Second, self-interest shapes what we pay attention to, even if it doesn't dictate our stance. For example, on Proposition 13, homeowners and public employees were more likely to have a well-formed opinion on the initiative, even if their opinion was inconsistent with their personal self-interest. But self-interest isn't the whole story. Principles, equality, individualism, ideals about government, human rights, and the like, may matter to us even when they violate our immediate self-interest. We may dislike hearing the views of some fringe political group, but support its right to speak because we treasure free speech. And perhaps the most important part of the story is this. Group interest is often a better predictor of political opinions than self-interest. Kinder says that in forming opinions, people seem to ask not, what's in it for me, but rather, what's in it for my group? Our group affiliation may be based on race, class, religion, gender, region, political party, industry, or countless other dimensions of difference. A related idea comes from James March, a professor at Stanford University, who proposes that we use two basic models to make decisions. The first model involves calculating consequences. We weigh our alternatives, assessing the value of each one, and we choose the alternative that yields us the most value. This model is the standard view of decision-making in economics classes. People are self-interested and rational. The rational agent asks, which sofa will provide me with the greatest comfort and the best aesthetics for the price? Which political candidate will best serve my economic and social interests? The second model is quite different. It assumes that people make decisions based on identity. They ask themselves three questions. Who am I? What kind of situation is this? And what do people like me do in this kind of situation? Notice that in the second model, people aren't analyzing the consequences or outcomes for themselves. There are no calculations, only norms and principles. Which sofa would someone like me, a Southeastern accountant, be more likely to buy? Which political candidate should a Hollywood Buddhist get behind? It's almost as if people consult in an ideal self-image. What would someone like me do? This second model of decision-making helps shed light on why the firefighters got angry about the popcorn popper. Bear in mind that the popcorn popper wasn't a bribe. If the marketer had said, "Order this film for your firehouse, and I'll give you a popcorn popper for your family," clearly most people would reject the offer on ethical grounds. On the contrary, the offer was innocuous. "We will give you a popcorn popper to thank you for the trouble you're taking to review the film. You can have the popper regardless of your decision on the film." There's nothing unethical about accepting this offer. And we can go further than that. From a self-interested, value-maximizing point of view, it is simply stupid to turn down this offer. If you make decision A, you end up with a popcorn popper. If you make decision B, you end up with no popcorn popper. Everything else is the same. So unless popcorn destroys value in your world, you'd better make decision A. But from the perspective of the identity model of decision-making, turning down the popper makes perfect sense. The thought process would be more like this. I'm a firefighter. You're offering me a popcorn popper to get me to view a film on safety, but firefighters aren't the kind of people who need little gifts to motivate us to learn about safety. We risk our lives going into burning buildings to save people. Shame on you for implying that I need a popcorn popper. There are ways to unite these two decision models. What if the marketer had offered to donate $50 to a school's fire safety program in exchange for the fireman's viewing the film? It's less clear that this offer would have violated the firefighter's sense of identity. Self-interest is important. There's no question that we can make people care by appealing to it, but it makes for a limited palette. Always structuring our ideas around self-interest is like always painting with one color. It's stifling for us and uninspiring for others. Floyd Lee, the manager of the Pegasus Dining Hall, has it right. He could have generated motivation through a strict self-interest appeal, perhaps by offering to let his employees off 10 minutes early every night if they worked hard, or by giving them the first choice of the steaks. Instead, he helped create a kind of Pegasus identity. A Pegasus chef is in charge of morale, not food. You can imagine hundreds of decisions being made by staffers in the tent who think to themselves, what should a Pegasus person do in this situation? Clinic. The need for algebra and Maslow's basement. The situation. Every algebra teacher in recorded history has had to deal with two student questions. Why do I need to know this? When will I ever use this? This clinic examines three attempts to answer these questions. Message 1. In a 1993 conference on Algebra for All, the following points were made in response to the question, why study algebra? Algebra provides methods for moving from the specific to the general. It involves discovering the patterns among items in a set and developing the language needed to think about and communicate it to others. Algebra provides procedures for manipulating symbols to allow for understanding of the world around us. Algebra provides a vehicle for understanding our world through mathematical models. Algebra is the science of variables. It enables us to deal with large bodies of data by identifying variables, quantities which change in value, and by imposing or finding structures within the data. Algebra is the basic set of ideas and techniques for describing and reasoning about relations between variable quantities. Comments on Message 1. This message illustrates the problems posed by the curse of knowledge. Presumably, this conference was filled with a group of algebra experts, and they came up with an answer that seemed plausible to other experts. But let's get real. Will any restless student jump on the algebra bandwagon after being told that it provides procedures for manipulating symbols to allow for understanding of the world? As a definition of algebra, the bullets above seem quite logical. But as reasons for studying algebra, they don't work. We need a message that makes students care about algebra. Message 2. We made up the following response. It was inspired by several examples that we saw floating around the internet. Here's what I tell my students about why they need to learn algebra. You need it to get your high school diploma. Every future math and science class you take will require a knowledge of algebra. To get admitted to a good college, you'll need a good record in math. And even if you don't ever plan to attend college, the reasoning skills you learn in algebra will help you buy a home, create a budget, etc. My brother is a sales rep for a high-tech firm. He always had trouble with math in school, but now realizes the hard work he put into the course has improved his analytical skills and has made him a better presenter to his clients. Comments on Message 2. This teacher avoids the curse of knowledge by speaking practically, but he stays close to Maslow's basement. Why study algebra? The first reason, you have to do it because you have to do it. The second, you have to do it so that you can do more of it. The primary appeal is to esteem, the desire to be competent, to gain approval and status. The most effective part is the part about the author's brother who later realized that his struggles with math paid off. The brother story is an esteem appeal that builds in an almost Cable-esque victory story. They laughed when I botched the equation, but when I won the account. Message 3. This is a response from a high school algebra teacher, Dean Sherman, to an internet discussion of this topic among high school teachers. My grade 9 students have difficulty appreciating the usefulness of the standard form of the equation of a line, prompting them to ask, "When are we ever going to need this?" The question used to really bother me, and I would look, as a result, for justification for everything I taught. Now I say, "Never. You will never use this." I then go on to remind them that people don't lift weights so that they will be prepared should one day someone knock them over on the street and lay a barbell across their chests. You lift weights so that you can knock over a defensive lineman, or carry your groceries, or lift your grandchildren without being sore the next day. You do math exercises so that you can improve your ability to think logically, so that you can be a better lawyer, doctor, architect, prison warden, or parent. Math is mental weight training. It is a means to an end for most people, not an end in itself. Comments on Message 3. This is a great response. Note the elements we've seen before in the book. The surprise opening to grab attention. Never, you will never use this. Also, the use of analogy is brilliant. He taps our existing schema of weightlifting to change our model of learning algebra, i.e., it's not that in the future you're going to have a daily need to find the slope of a line. It's that you're making your brain more muscular. He is also moving up Maslow's hierarchy. The appeal here is to higher levels of learning and self-actualization. The idea is that learning algebra makes you realize more of your potential. Punchline. Math is mental weight training reminds us that even in the most mundane situations, there's an opportunity to move out of Maslow's basement and into the higher levels of motivation. Don't mess with Texas. Dan Sirik is the nation's leading researcher on litter. He has worked with 16 states, from New York to Alaska, on anti-litter initiatives. He often begins his projects by selecting random stretches of road, from interstates to farm roads, and walking the roads personally, a clicker in each hand, manually counting litter. In the 1980s, Sirik and his Sacramento-based organization, the Institute for Applied Research, were hired by the state of Texas. Texas had a serious litter problem. The state was spending $25 million per year on cleanup, and the costs were rising 15% per year. The state's attempts to encourage better behavior, please don't litter signs, lots of roadside trash cans marked pitch in, weren't working. Texas hired Sirik to help craft a new strategy. The standard anti-litter message is emotional, but it tends to focus on a limited set of emotions. There are appeals to guilt and shame, as in a spot that shows a Native American shedding a tear over litter. There are also appeals to our feelings for cuddly wildlife, such as the campaign starring a cartoon owl who says, "Give a hoot, don't pollute." Sirik knew that this type of messaging wouldn't solve Texas's problem. In his view, those kinds of ads are just preaching to the choir. What Texas needed to do was reach people who weren't inclined to shed tears over roadside trash. The profile of the typical litterer in Texas was an 18 to 35-year-old pickup-driving male who liked sports and country music. He didn't like authority, and he wasn't motivated by emotional associations with cuddly owls. One member of the Texas Department of Transportation said, "Saying please to these guys falls on deaf ears." "We found that people who throw the stuff are real slobs," Sirik says. "You had to explain to them that what they were doing was littering." Sirik kept with him a photo of a macho-looking man in the pickup truck. "This is our target market," he said. "We call him Bubba." Designing an anti-litter campaign based on self-interest wasn't likely to work with this group. After all, what do the Bubbas really have to gain by not littering? Throwing things away properly takes effort, for which there are no obvious rewards. The situation doesn't lend itself to a greed or sex-based appeal, a la Caples. It might be possible to design a fear-based approach, highlighting the hefty fines or other punishments, but the Bubba's anti-authority streak would likely render it useless, or even cause it to backfire. Sirik knew that the best way to change Bubba's behavior was to convince him that people like him did not litter. Based on his research, the Texas Department of Transportation approved a campaign built around the slogan, "Don't mess with Texas." One of the earliest TV commercials featured two Dallas Cowboy players who were famous in Texas, defensive end Ed Too Tall Jones and defensive tackle Randy White. In the spot, they're picking up trash on the side of a highway. Too Tall Jones steps toward the camera and says, "You see the guy who threw this out the window? You tell him I got a message for him." Randy White steps forward with a beer can and says, "I got a message for him too." An off-camera voice asks, "What's that?" White crushes the can with his fist and says threateningly, "Well, I kind of need to see him to deliver it." Too Tall Jones adds, "Don't mess with Texas." This commercial is a far cry from cute owls and weepy Native Americans. Another ad features Houston Astros pitcher Mike Scott, famous for his split-fingered fastball. Scott says that throwing stuff away is the Texas thing to do. He demonstrates his split-fingered trash ball, hurling some litter into a roadside can, which explodes with a pillar of fire. Subtle stuff. The campaign featured athletes and musicians, most of whom probably weren't household names outside Texas, but were all well known to Texans as Texans. Houston Oiler quarterback Warren Moon, boxer George Foreman, blues guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan, and country artist Jerry Jeff Walker. Willie Nelson contributed an ad with the line, "Mamas, tell all your babies, don't mess with Texas." But isn't this just a garden variety celebrity endorsement? No, it's more subtle than that. Certainly these spots are not driven by pure celebrity. Barbara Streisand wouldn't pack much of a punch with Bubba. And even macho celebrities wouldn't have worked the same way. Schwarzenegger is macho but does nothing to evoke Texanness. What if the campaign used the same celebrities but adopted a more conventional PSA-type approach? I'm pro boxer George Foreman. It's uncool to litter. That, too, would be unlikely to work. Foreman would be stepping into the authority role that Bubba hates. The message of the campaign was, Texans don't litter. Notice that the celebrities were valuable only insofar as they can quickly establish the schema of Texas, or more specifically, of ideal masculine Texans. Even people who dislike Willie Nelson's music can appreciate his quality of Texan-ness. The campaign was an instant success. Within a few months of the launch, an astonishing 73% of Texans polled could recall the message and identify it as an anti-litter message. Within 1 year, litter had declined 29%. The Department of Transportation originally planned to accompany the Don't Mess with Texas campaign with a separate $1 million program to enforce litter laws more vigorously. This was a fear tactic. If you litter, you're more likely to get caught and prosecuted. But the effect of Don't Mess with Texas was so strong and immediate that the enforcement program was abandoned. By offering Bubba a compelling message about identity, the campaign made appeals to fear unnecessary. During the first 5 years of the campaign, visible roadside litter in Texas decreased 72%, and the number of cans along Texas roads dropped 81%. In 1988, Sirik found that Texas had less than half the trash he found along the roads of other states that had run anti-litter programs for comparable periods. Don't mess with Texas as a phrase is a great slogan, but we shouldn't confuse the slogan with the idea. The idea was that Sirik could make Bubba care about litter by showing him that real Texans didn't litter. The idea was that Bubba would respond to an identity appeal better than he would to a rational self-interest appeal. Even if a second-rate copywriter had been hired and the slogan had been, Don't disrespect Texas, the campaign would still have decreased cans on Texas highways. The music of duo piano. So far, we've looked at three strategies for making people care. Using associations or avoiding associations, as the case may be. Appealing to self-interest and appealing to identity. All three strategies can be effective, but we've got to watch out for our old nemesis, the curse of knowledge, which can interfere with our ability to implement them. In 2002, Chip helped a group of professors lead a seminar for nonprofit arts leaders in Miami and Fort Lauderdale, Florida. One of the exercises was intended to help the leaders articulate and refine the core mission of their organization. The questions put to the attendees were difficult ones. Why does your organization exist? Can other organizations do what you do? And if so, what is it you do that is unique? One question asked participants to define the purpose of their organization in a way that would motivate other people to care about it. Volunteers must care enough to contribute their time. Donors must care enough to donate their money. And employees must care enough to stick by the organization, even when they get lucrative job offers from other for-profit organizations. One of the organizations attending the seminar was the Murray Drenoff Duo Piano Foundation. When it was their turn, Chip asked the representatives to read their emotion-evoking purpose statement. Duo Piano Group. We exist to protect, preserve, and promote the music of duo piano. Chip. Why is it important to protect the music of duo piano? Duo Piano Group. Well, not much duo piano music is being performed anymore. We want to keep it from dying out. One attendee admitted later that when he first heard the phrase duo piano, he immediately thought of the dueling pianos that you find in touristy bars with people drunkenly singing along to Piano Man. Some people in the room thought that perhaps the death of duo piano music should not be prevented but hastened. The conversation went around in circles for a few minutes without much progress in making the people in the room care about duo piano as an art form. Finally, one of the other participants chimed in. I don't want to be rude, but why would the world be a less rich place if duo piano music disappeared completely? Duo Piano Group, clearly taken aback. Wow! The piano is this magnificent instrument. It was created to put the entire range and tonal quality of the whole orchestra under the control of one performer. There is no other instrument that has the same breadth and range. And when you put two of these magnificent instruments in the same room, and the performers can respond to each other and build on each other, it's like having the sound of the orchestra but the intimacy of chamber music. At that point, surprised brows went up around the room and there was an audible murmur of approval. This phrase, "the sound of the orchestra but the intimacy of chamber music," was profound and evocative. Suddenly the people in the room understood, for the first time, why the Murray Dranoff team was, and should be, committed to the duo piano. Why did it take 10 minutes for the Murray Dranoff group to come up with a message that made other people care? You'd think that a group devoted to the duo piano would be in the best position of anyone on earth to explain the value of the music. The reality is that they did, in fact, know better than anyone on earth why the duo piano was worth preserving. But the curse of knowledge prevented them from expressing it well. The mission to preserve duo piano music was effective and meaningful inside Murray Dranoff, but outside the organization it was opaque. Several attendees later commented that they had sympathized with the question, why would the world be a less rich place if duo piano music disappeared completely? What's so special about the duo piano? Who cares? If you come to work every day for years, focused on duo piano issues, it's easy to forget that a lot of the world has never heard of the duo piano. It's easy to forget that you're the tapper and the world is the listener. The duo piano group was rescued from the curse of knowledge by a room full of people relentlessly asking them, why? By asking why 3 times, the duo piano group moved from talking about what they were doing to why they were doing it. They moved from a set of associations that had no power, except to someone who already knew duo piano music, to a set of deeper, more concrete associations that connected emotionally with outsiders. This tactic of the 3 whys can be useful in bypassing the curse of knowledge. Toyota actually has a 5 whys process for getting to the bottom of problems on its production line. Feel free to use as many whys as you like. Asking why helps to remind us of the core values, the core principles that underlie our ideas. A few years back, a group of hospital administrators asked the design firm IDEO to help improve the hospital's workflow. The team at IDEO knew that they would probably face a lot of internal resistance to their recommendations. The first step in motivating the hospital staff to change was to get them to realize that there was a problem and get them to care about it. IDEO created a video, shot from the perspective of a patient who goes to the emergency room for a leg fracture. In the video, we see what the patient sees. We are the patient. We come in through the door to the ER. We hunt around for check-in instructions and interact with the admissions people, who are speaking in a foreign medical tongue. Eventually, we are laid on a gurney and wheeled through the hospital. We see long stretches of the hospital ceiling. We hear disembodied voices because we can't see the person addressing us. Every now and then, someone pokes his or her head into our field of view. Frequently, there are long pauses where we just sit idle, staring at the ceiling, unsure of what's coming next. Jane Fulton Suri, a psychologist at IDEO, said that when the hospital staff was shown the video, it had an immediate impact. The first reaction was always something like, "Oh, I never realized." Suri says she likes the word realized. Before the hospital workers saw the video, the problem wasn't quite real. Afterwards, she said, there's an immediate motivation to fix things. It's no longer just some problem on a problem list. IDEO also created role-playing exercises, putting the staffers in the patient's shoes. The exercises included such tasks as, imagine that you are French and you are trying to locate your father in the hospital, but you don't speak any English. IDEO has become known for this type of simulation, simulations that drive employees to empathize with their customers. Time seems to erode empathy in some contexts, and IDEO's simulations manage to restore the natural empathy that we have for others. The world of business tends to emphasize the pattern over the particular, Surrey said. The intellectual aspects of the pattern prevent people from caring. This realization, that empathy emerges from the particular rather than the pattern, brings us back, full circle, to the Mother Teresa quote at the beginning of the chapter. If I look at the mass, I will never act. If I look at the one, I will. How can we make people care about our ideas? We get them to take off their analytical hats. We create empathy for specific individuals. We show how our ideas are associated with things that people already care about. We appeal to their self-interest, but we also appeal to their identities, not only to the people they are right now, but also to the people they would like to be. And while we should always think about what's in it for our audience, we should remember to stay clear of Maslow's basement. What's in it for our audience might be aesthetic motivation or the desire for transcendence rather than the $250 bonus. Floyd Lee said, "As I see it, I'm not just in charge of food service. I am in charge of morale." Who wouldn't want a leader like Floyd Lee? Chapter 6. Stories. The nurse was working in the neonatal intensive care unit, where newborns with serious health problems are treated and monitored. She'd been watching one baby in particular for several hours, and she didn't like what she was seeing. His color, a key indicator of potential problems, had been fluctuating, wavering between a healthy shade of pink and a duller, more troublesome hue. Suddenly, within a matter of seconds, the baby turned a deep blue-black. The nurse's stomach fell. Others in the ICU yelled for an X-ray technician and a doctor. The gathering medical team was operating on the assumption that the baby's lung had collapsed, a common problem for babies on ventilators. The team prepared for the typical response to a collapsed lung, which involves piercing the chest and inserting a tube to suck the air from around the collapsed lung, allowing it to reinflate. But the nurse thought it was a heart problem. As soon as she saw the baby's color, that awful blue-black, she suspected a pneumopericardium, a condition in which air fills the sac surrounding the heart, pressing inward and preventing the heart from beating. The nurse was terrified because the last time she witnessed a pneumopericardium, the baby died before the problem could even be diagnosed. The nurse tried to stop the frantic preparations to treat the lung. "It's the heart," she said. But in response, the other medical personnel pointed to the heart monitor, which showed the baby's heart was fine. His heart rate was bouncing along steadily at the normal newborn rate of 130 beats per minute. The nurse, still insistent, pushed their hands away and screamed for quiet as she lowered a stethoscope to check for a heartbeat. There was no sound. The heart was not beating. She started doing compressions on the baby's chest. The chief neonatologist burst into the room, and the nurse slapped a syringe in his hand. "It's a pneumopericardium," she said. "Stick the heart." The X-ray technician, who was finally receiving results from his scan, confirmed the nurse's diagnosis. The neonatologist guided the syringe into the heart and slowly released the air that had been strangling the baby's heart. The baby's life was saved. His color slowly returned to normal. Later, the group realized why the heart monitor misled them. It is designed to measure electrical activity, not actual heartbeats. The baby's heart nerves were firing, telling the heart to beat at the appropriate rate, but the air in the sac around the heart prevented the heart from actually beating. Only when the nurse used the stethoscope, so she could hear whether the heart was pumping correctly, did it become clear that his heart had stopped. This story was collected by Gary Klein, a psychologist who studies how people make decisions in high-pressure, high-stakes environments. He spends time with firefighters, air traffic controllers, power plant operators, and intensive care workers. The story about the baby appears in a chapter called The Power of Stories in Klein's book, Sources of Power. Klein says that in the environments he studies, stories are told and retold because they contain wisdom. Stories are effective teaching tools. They show how context can mislead people to make the wrong decisions. Stories illustrate causal relationships that people hadn't recognized before and highlight unexpected, resourceful ways in which people have solved problems. Medically, the story related above teaches important lessons. It instructs people in how to spot and treat the specific condition, pneumopericardium. More broadly, it warns medical personnel about relying too much on machines.